Mr. Doherty, reel 5.
The Japs never learned anything.
I think that you said that you learnt some Japanese songs. Can you remember any?
Oh, crikey. Yeah, which one?
Whichever you can remember.
Cool. Well, I think the... Hi nano yoru, hi nano yoru yo. Minato no akari munasaki no yoru. No poru janku no yume no yoru. I'm no singer. Ah, wasurare nu kokyunane. Hi nano yoru yo. Yume no yoru. Or would you prefer Dina or Watashiwakapito? That should be more your line.
I know the song, but not the words.
Yeah, Dinos or anything finer, but all stuff like that. But it's very old fashioned stuff to the Japanese these days. Yes.
Can you tell me how you came to be released?
Yes, well, it was all a funny sort of an affair. A bloke called Tokalup I'd got on one of my escape aids out on my coconut patrols, and suddenly he motioned me to be silent.
He was a Kanaka, was he?
This was a Kanaka, yes. He motioned me to be silent. And then he turned round to me. I couldn't hear anything, it was dead quiet. Then he turned round me and he told me the war was over. And I says, how did he know? And he didn't tell me. So, about 3 days afterwards, I think it was, a Japanese sergeant major called for me, and he said, the Second World, on the 18th of August 1945, the Second World War is now over. Well, I knew it was for what Tokalup had said, but I didn't really believe what Tokalup had said. And it was over. So I sat down and they brought me out a pair of boots. I hadn't worn boots for God knows how long. I put these boots on. I felt very awkward in them. And they gave me some bananas and a cigarette. And after a couple of days, they took me across the island. Well, I met up with the others, well, those that remained. They all laughed at me, but I had long hair and a long beard. And I greeted them, not with hello, mates, Ohio, because I am a Sioux. They laughed like hell at me. But I found that every now and again I'd come out with Japanese words instead of the English words. And I felt like a little boy just home from school, been playing truant and getting back into lessons again. So they told me to sit down and they cut my hair. Rotten buggers had cut my hair into a bob and shaved me and left me like that. Well, they was all shaved. Their heads were shaved off right to the skin, right to the scalp. All of them, you see. And then the Japanese came in and they told us we've got to say we was well treated. A bloke named Dyer said, no, buggered if we will. And I felt like telling the bloke to shut up because they'd knock us off if we weren't careful. But he was, it was the typical bloke to say that sort of thing. And after a little while, we was taken to another camp over onto the mainland in this boat. And
this was the mainland of New Britain.
Mainland of New Britain, yeah. Into Rabaul. And the Japs were undecided what to do with us. So Igaki, our translator, sat us down. He wouldn't tell us what was happening. We said what was happening, and he didn't want to answer us. And I couldn't get the gist of the Japanese because they were speaking so quickly. I didn't know what they were talking about. And in the time, I says, just out of the spur of the moment, I says, did they ever discover an atomic bomb? To Igaki, and it is as though I'd punched him straight in between the eyes.
Igaki was the translator, was he?
Yeah. He says, how did you know? I said, I don't know, I'm asking you. But still didn't know. And then a senior ranking officer came onto the into this place where they got us all penned up together. And he went along the line of officers and slapped everyone across the face and shouted at them and saying that it was not the Emperor's wishes. And that was the first time I realised he was trying to kill us. These officers was all being told off because they what they wanted to do was to silence us for good and wipe the lot out so as nothing would come out in history at all. But whoever this officer was, he came in and said it was against the Emperor's wishes. And then they gave us a big sack of rice, for which we had no need of at all. And they put us all on a lorry with another bloke they found somewhere, I don't know where he came from, and took us down to the docks. And there for the first time we met the white man again. He was Commander Morris of HMAS Vendetta. And, God, it was good to see him. Anyway, the sailors seemed to think the world of the rice, so they had it. And all our officers was lined up, the Japanese officers, that is. And Commander Morris took us on board, and the sailors gave me a nice short back and side, so I looked smart. And all the others had their ear cropped. And they took us from there, back in this destroyer, the Vendetta. And it was rough passage as well. The old tin tub didn't half rock about. And they got us back to Jackano Bay. Jackano Bay is in New Britain. And there, everybody came off the ship. When it came to my turn, of course, they didn't reckon I was a prisoner. Because I had this decent hair cut and combed nice and clean. New uniform on by now. I don't know whose uniform it was, but somebody's. And they took me to the to Lae, New Guinea. And there I stayed. One bloke, Paddy Smythe, his father was ill in England or something. So they put him on an aircraft to take him home. And then we heard the aircraft had crashed and he was killed. Where did we get to? Oh, I slung myself in the Busa River with delight and escaped from the Aussies, who reckoned I was Troppo. I flung myself in the Busa River and it swept me down onto a beach and then back again. And the Aussies came and got me and took me back to hospital, where they gave me a nurse to look after me. They was all very good to me, and then they said, well, you can be, as you can speak a bit of Japanese, you can be over these Japanese prisoners of war. Oh, they were a shower then. they was taking the mickey out of the Allies, saying they was ill and all this sort of business and wouldn't go out on working parties. And really, if they'd been under the Japanese, they would have really copped it. But here was blokes getting away with it all the time.
Malingering.
They took me into the hospital there, told me to walk up and down the beds there. Anyway, after I'd exchanged a few words with the Japanese there, they realised I spoke a bit of Japanese, and they came to detention and all that sort of caper because they didn't know who I was. They knew I wasn't Japanese, and obviously, and my Japanese was so brutal and soldier-like that now I realise it, all my speech was swearing. And then they took me back to Ley, New Guinea. Back to Australia from there, to Townsville. And there we spent a night, and we flew down to Brisbane. Oh yes, I was taking the mickey out of the Australian pilot about that blinking coat hanger. Wish I hadn't, though. Because when he got over Sydney Harbour Bridge, he turned the plane on its wing and kept going round in circles, and the bridge was going round and round and round and round. I said, all right, I've seen your bloody coat hanger. But it didn't make any difference.
What coat hanger was this?
The coat hanger was Sydney Harbour Bridge. Sydney Harbour Bridge.
You referred to it slightingly as a coat hanger.
Yeah, that's right. And he stood his plane on the side and went round and round and round. Anyway, I said I'd seen his coat hanger. And they took us down to Melbourne. And there I was put in Heidelberg Hospital. Sir William Duggan invited us out to a theatre show or something like that. He was the General of Australia or something. And then I went back into hospital, and they gave me these bombs to clear me out and put me up. And soon I was putting on fat again. I got fit.
What, by bombs? You mean laxatives?
Laxatives, yeah. Then I got fit, and they said I could go out. So I went down to Flinders Street Station to have my first night out. I pushed open the doors of Young and Jackson's public house, and as I pushed the doors open, something hit me straight in between the eyes, and I finished up back in Heidelberg Hospital. As a nurse explained, it was all a case of mistaken identity. It wasn't much to me. So that was just an incident.
What had happened? You thought you'd seen somebody that you hadn't.
I didn't see anybody. If somebody saw me, thought I was somebody else, I suppose, and the bunch of fives was straight in between the eyes, and I ended up in the road. They took me back to Heidelberg Hospital, where I was put back again, you see. And then they gave me a pass to see my auntie in Western Australia. So I nipped across there, across the Nullarbors, down to Katanning,
to Kojuna.
Katanning. Down to Kojuna, and saw what I'd never seen my auntie before, but I just walked inside the door and sat down. She said, who are you when you think you're home? And then she suddenly sees a photograph of my old man up on the wall and realised I was her nephew. So I stayed with her for a few weeks. And I decided to go round the bush, and I enjoyed myself all the way round Australia at the expense of the British tourist, what is it, the British liaison office, Toorak Road, Melbourne. I sent them a letter through to ask them for a packet of 200 cigarettes, and they sent them through to me to Western Australia with the grim reminder that it's not the position of a British soldier to ask the liaison office for cigarettes, but they gave them to me all the same. They're very good. And then, of course, I came back to England. Now, what I've got What I've left out, I don't know, because it's such a long story. You could go through about 10 of your tapes and still not get out of it.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment has left any long-term effects on you in any way?
I think my term of imprisonment was, in a very queer way, the most beneficial thing that ever happened in my lifetime. It was a thing of a discipline in itself, where I went into the army thinking I was God Almighty. I thought I ruled the world and the world belonged to me, and I could go along and punch Belicha beacons and knock their china tops off into the road with impunity. I thought that if a bloke came down the street and I didn't like him, I could punch his head off. I thought I knew everything. I came out and I realised I knew nothing. When I came to know that I knew nothing and accepted the fact, I started to learn. I started to learn how to paint, learn how to write, learn how, most importantly, learn how to think. And so, after 40 odd years, I sit here. I can write a book. I can talk a few languages. I can paint a picture. I can build my home, as you've already seen. I can put my hand to anything, and nothing is too hard. I don't know if this got anything to do with the record, really, but it just gives you some idea of my idea of what it's done. Really, it was a terrible experience, but I think it's an experience most of us need. It's a bit of discipline in our lives to make us realise that we're human beings. We have a role to play, and no matter how small it may be, we've got a role to play in the world.
What do you feel about the Japanese today?
Well, I think I said before, I'm not certain, but you see, the Japanese are a different race, and they're Japanese. The Japanese are brought up in their way and their ideas. What's good for the Japanese may not be good for us. What's good for us might not be good for the Japanese. So therefore we have two concepts to think about. This is what I mean by thinking. And if anybody thinks, they can think along the same way. If two people are brought up with different ideas, they must differ. So the terrible things the Japanese may have done, to our eyes, seems unforgivable. I think I've said all this, have I? I don't know. But therefore, then again, the things that we did, you see, we surrendered at Singapore. Have you thought for 1 minute what a terrible thing that is in the eyes of the Japanese? You see, there's two ways to look at it. It's a great thing. It's an honour to the Japanese if they should commit suicide. But on our side, it's a sin and an admittance of failure if we commit suicide. So we've got different ways of looking at life. Japanese have their ways, we have ours. They're good workers, extremely hard workers. We have our way, they have theirs. What I think of the Japanese? Well, as human beings, they're quite likeable little fellas in some ways. And they're horrible little buggers in other ways. But that's my point of view, you see. I mean, I don't think anything about it. I wrote to the Emperor of Japan and I apologised personally to him, to which he replied to me. I apologise for the behaviour of the British prisoners of war to him who was a guest of this country, who visited this country and should be treated so appallingly. I apologise to that man, which I think he deserved. Not because he's the Emperor of Japan, because he was a human being. His counsellors wrote back to me and understood and thanked me for my letter. I think, but a lot of prisoners of war would say, oh, what the hell, you know, couldn't do that because the people that's dead. Well, it can't do the people that's dead any harm by being human, surely. That's the way I look at it. I wonder how many of those 600 were alive today. There was 12 got out. But I wonder how many are left today.
You mean that there are 600 taken to the whole of New Britain?
Hmm.
And to your knowledge, only 12 survived?
12, to my knowledge, it's 12 got out, yeah. 1940, there was 1945, rather, there was 12 of us. But when they lined up, you see, at Changi, and there were 600, it took a vast area of parade ground. But then there's 12 of us left, with blankets around us. You know, look, a pitiful sight, and I often wonder how many of them are left today. There'll be Paddy Nolan, Michael Ahern, Bugliss, Baker, there's four of them. I can't think of their names, and it's so silly because I did remember all their names. Gabbett, Dykes, seven of them, Smythe. Yeah. Joe Blythe, Dorky White,